A new project dubbed the Deep Carbon Observatory is just getting underway. It's really more of a plan than an actual observatory at this point, but the idea is to catalog and quantify all the carbon that's under Earth's surface. Why do scientists want this information, and what might it be useful for? Well, here to answer that question is my guest. Robert Hazen is the principal investigator for the Deep Carbon Observatory. He's a senior staff scientist at the Carnegie Institution for Science's Geophysical Laboratory, and he's also a professor of earth sciences at George Mason University. Robert Hazen, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Joe. Great to be with you.
And I should mention that the project that you're working on is funded by the Sloan Foundation, which, as it happens, also funds Science Friday.
They're a great organization.
Well, they show good taste. I guess that's what we want to say. Anyway, if you want to join this conversation and learn more about the Deep Carbon Observatory, give us a call. The number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and you can send us a tweet, at SciFry. So, Robert Hazen, what is the Deep Carbon Observatory?
Well, our Deep Carbon Observatory is a broadly interdisciplinary. It's international. It's an effort to understand carbon from the crust to the core, at scales all the way from nano to global. And this is sort of a globally distributed observatory, if you will, in the sense, you know, we need new instruments, just like scientists who want to study the heavens need a new observatory every so often. But this is an observatory that's going to have instruments that help us probe deep samples from the Earth, from drill cores and from volcanoes. We're going to be able to analyze them with a new set of instruments. We're going to have the ability to simulate high temperatures and high pressures in a laboratory to mimic those conditions in the deep Earth. And we need theoretical models that help us do all of these things and understand the context of the deep Earth. So our observatory is this grand global international distributed observatory.
I see. And give me an example. I mean, it's not just drilling deep holes and pulling up what's down there?
Absolutely not. Of course, that's an important part of getting deep samples, but we also get deep samples from volcanoes, and so we want to monitor every volcano on Earth, understand, for example, how much CO2 is coming out of those 500-plus volcanoes from more than 20,000 miles of volcanic arcs around the world. We want to understand deep life, and, you know, there's a vast reservoir of deep life. Some people think the total biomass beneath the surface is greater than all the elephants and trees and ants and stuff you see at the surface.
Is it more underground than
underground? It's microbial life. If you drill a hole, Joe, just about any place on Earth, you go down a mile, 2 miles down, bring up that drill core, you find that there are microbes, sparse to be sure, very hardy microbes that are living in the rock. It's a huge biomass, and we just don't know very much about it at all.
Wow. Wow. And is this starting, or has it started, or is it still in the future to begin?
Well, we have literally hundreds, maybe thousands of scientists around the world who are working on different aspects of deep carbon right now in my laboratory at the Carnegie Institution. We have a number of people who are working on aspects of it. But what we're trying to do here is coordinate, integrate, and think big. Make this a global project with thousands of people who are coordinating their efforts. I mean, imagine having a monitoring system on every volcano on Earth where in a science classroom, you can go and you can punch up Philippines. I want to see what Mount Pinatubo is doing today. And there's a video feed from Mount Pinatubo, and you can get real-time information on how much CO2 is coming out of that volcano. That's just one of many aspects that we see as this Deep Carbon Observatory, the global effort.
Totally interesting. Well, we're going to have to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about this, and we'll take your questions at 800-989-8255. So don't go away. We'll be talking about the deep Earth. This is Talk of the Nations. I'm sorry. This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Joe Palca. We're talking with Robert Hazen. He's the principal investigator for the Deep Carbon Observatory Project. He's also a senior staff scientist at the Carnegie Institution for Science's Geophysical Laboratory, and he's a professor of earth science at George Mason University. And we're talking about something called the Deep Carbon Observatory, which is a Sloan Foundation project. And we've got a lot of people are very interested in this, so why don't we start with a call from John in Scottsdale, Arizona. John, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, how far is it to the center of the Earth, and how hot is it are we estimating?
Okay. Robert Hazen, do you know those answers?
Sure. The Earth is about 4,000 miles in radius, so you'd have to go down 4,000 miles, a lot deeper than we can drill. And when you get down there, the pressure is more than 3 million times atmospheric pressure. The temperature, it's a little bit a matter of debate, but certainly several thousand degrees in the order of 5,000 Celsius. So it's a very hot, very pressurized place. And that's one of the reasons we want to develop new high-temperature and high-pressure devices that will help us mimic those conditions in the laboratory so we can take things like iron and see how much carbon dissolves in the iron at conditions of the core. Maybe the core hides a huge amount of carbon that we don't know about.
We also have a call question here from Second Life. Would they measure the isotopic mix of the carbon as well?
Oh, that's a great question, because the isotopic mix is so important. You know, one of the big exciting questions we want to address is the source of deep methane or deep natural gas. You know, companies around the world are discovering more and more very deep natural gas reserves, some of them many miles down. And the question is all of that the result of deep biology? In other words, is all the methane coming somehow directly or indirectly from life? Or might there be much deeper sources, deeper sources in the mantle? So we're talking maybe 200 miles or 300 miles down where the methane is produced, and then it works its way to the surface. And one way to tell is to study the isotopes of carbon, which can be in the carbon-12 or carbon-13 variety, and the isotopes of hydrogen, which can be either hydrogen or the heavier version, deuterium. And the mixture of those carbon and hydrogen isotopes can actually reveal the temperature, the conditions under which that methane forms. So isotopes are very important in our work.
And so I just want to make sure I'm understanding this. The idea is that it is kind of given, received wisdom, that the fossil fuels that we use are all come from fossils, that they're broken down organic material from what was something once alive. But you're saying that there might be a different process which are also producing the same kinds of things, but not through living material, but some other chemical process.
Yes, there's new evidence emerging that, well, of course, many of the fossil fuels, most of the fossil fuels, arise through biological processes, either directly by burial or indirectly by processing of organic matter deep within the earth. There is some suggestion that you can also make hydrocarbons and other interesting organic molecules at very high pressure, high temperature conditions where there are chemical reactions. And this is interesting not only from the point of view of possible sources of carbon-rich hydrocarbons, fuels, and that sort of thing, but also, could this have played a role in the origin of life?
Very interesting. Okay, let's take another call now and go to AJ in Chicago, Illinois. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. And my question is pertaining to the way that you're taking these measurements. You're obviously looking at different depths where this carbon is being manufactured. And I was wondering about the areas that are close to the top. Why can't you use that same idea in order to drill for energy that we need desperately by means of the places? The same thing as it would be in Yellowstone, where you have the geyser coming up.
Interesting.
Where you push the water down, you have in areas that are very close to the top, and have electrical systems, turbines that could be run in order to generate energy.
Interesting question, AJ. Bob Hazen, what about that?
Well, of course, we're very excited at the developments in various drilling technologies and the ability to recover deep samples. We want to develop new ways of recovering deep microbial samples, for example, and this involves sequestering those samples. So there's a whole groups of new technologies that are needed. But also, what we learn about the way carbon exists and how it interacts with rocks deep underground, this may lead to new ways of, for example, sequestering CO2 underground and pumping it back down. So these drilling and pumping technologies are not only important for finding energy sources, but also for basic science, understanding microbes, understanding the rocks that are down there, and perhaps for remediation, for getting reducing our CO2 output by burying some of it deep in those rock reservoirs.
So these are possibilities that this project will allow you to explore?
Well, we're very interested in the fundamental science of how fluids and rocks interact at high pressure, because the fluids deep within the Earth, they're primarily water and CO2. There may also be some sulfur and nitrogen and some other components, but those water CO2 mixtures, that's what's interacting with the deep rock in the crust, in the shallow mantle. This is what's coming out of the volcanoes. So we really need, if we're going to understand deep carbon, we have to understand that very fundamental scientific question of how fluids at high temperature and high pressure interact with rocks.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay, let's try a call now from Conrad in Chandler, Arizona. Conrad, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, how deep exactly through the Earth's crust could we drill?
Conrad, do you mind if I just ask you one quick question?
Okay.
What grade are you in?
Fifth. Think.
Okay. Fifth, you think. All right. Well, that's good. Thanks for answering that. I was just curious. Okay. Go ahead, Bob Hazen, a fifth grade question.
Conrad, that is a terrific question. It's one that we are thinking so hard about these days. And I'll tell you, we're excited about the possibility of revisiting what was a very famous engineering drilling project years and years ago, decades ago, called Project MOHO, the idea of drilling through a very thin part of the crust into Earth's mantle. It never quite worked, but we think there may be new technologies that will allow us to drill, gosh, maybe 6, 7, 8 miles down. That's possible, and if we could do that, the thinnest part of the crust is only 5 or 6 miles thick, so we might actually be able to achieve this Project MOHO, to drill down there and actually bring up a piece of the mantle and find out how much carbon's down there, find out other things about Earth's interior. And this is so fundamental to understanding our planet. This is a very exciting object. Conrad, that's a great question.
Yeah, Conrad, thank you. I thought I detected a child or a younger person's voice, and I just wanted to congratulate you for calling in like that. So I'm still curious, though. How far away are these technologies? Is this just a question of having the money to put down these drills or to dig the holes, or do we need a new set of technologies in order to realize some of these drills?
Oh, Joe. Oh, you hit the nail on the head. Money. You said money. Money is a big thing. We the Sloan Foundation is being very generous, but we need to use that money to leverage international efforts, perhaps getting some of the big energy companies, the oil and gas drilling companies involved. There's the International Ocean Drilling Project, which is tremendously important in achieving fundamental advances in drilling technologies and recovering deep samples. We are coordinating, collaborating with many people. The technology to drill deep is there.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly what is not so much there is the technology to recover pristine, uncontaminated samples from many miles down. Because what you want to do, of course, when you're drilling, is you have to lubricate the drill. You're creating lots. You put down mud and cooling fluids, and you're grinding away at the rock. But the core you retrieve, you want that to be as uncontaminated as possible. So, for example, you can recover microbes that haven't been contaminated by the microbes in the drilling mud that you use. So there's all these technological issues that we need to address, but the basic drilling technology with diamond drills, that's there, that's in place, it's just expensive.
I think I've heard that problem more than once in the past.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take one more call and go to Gary in Verona, Virginia. Gary, you're on the air with Science Friday.
Yes, thank you. I was wondering if you consider the limestone deposits to be part of the carbon reservoir.
Limestone.
Absolutely. And that's one of the fascinating things. You know, we're not only interested in the modern day distribution of carbon at and near the surface, and limestone's a tremendously important part of that. We're interested in looking back in Earth history, back 1 billion years, 2 billion years, 4.5 billion years. And what we see is that the near surface, the crust and the mantle, the distribution of carbon must have changed dramatically, because there were no limestones during those first 1 billion years of Earth history, certainly none that we know about, and limestones have only been precipitated in huge amounts because of life. And this coevolution of the near-surface biosphere and the near-surface geosphere is a fascinating aspect, looking at that changing through life. Of course, today, limestone is a tremendously important part of the carbon cycle. It locks up a huge amount of carbon at and near the surface. and we need to understand how that's changed over time.
You know, I hope this isn't a goofy question, but why carbon? I mean, why not nitrogen or phosphorus or something else?
No, that's the most important question. Carbon, it's just unique. It's the element of life. Every biomolecule is carbon-based. You know, when you look at a tree or an elephant, you look at any other living thing, you're looking at carbon-based chemicals. And it's not just that. I mean, carbon chemistry is the basis of plastic and paints and glues and dyes and lubricants and all the pharmaceuticals we take. And, of course, all of our energy, most of our energy these days is carbon chemistry. So it's an incredibly important element. It's the central element in concerns of environment and climate, environment, health, all these things. This is all carbon-based, and we're incredibly ignorant about carbon just, you know, a few hundred feet below the surface of the Earth.
Wow. Now, this is not just a U.S. project. I think I was reading that there are other countries that are getting involved in this.
We have about 30 countries involved right now, about 400 researchers, and we expect that to grow perhaps to more than 1,000 people, and this is a wide-open project right now. It's tremendously exciting. For example, if you're going to study volcanoes, you need to have observers in all of those countries and have cooperative agreements with it. So forming these liaisons and getting other scientists in other parts of the world excited about it is a big part of what we're doing.
We're talking with Bob Hazen. He's the principal investigator for something called the Deep Carbon Observatory Project. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Science Friday from NPR News. So are the bugs, the bacteria that you're getting from these deep cores, are they anything like these bacteria that people are finding at these extremophiles, these vents at the bottom of the ocean?
Absolutely. The deepest microbes that have been found, some of them in 2 mile or more deep gold mines in South Africa, where scientists go down and pull them out of the fluids from the rock, and others from drill cores, they are these primitive archaea, these extremophiles. But I'll tell you what we think is an even more exciting sort of unknown frontier. And this sort of goes under the heading, there are things we know we don't know, but then there are things we don't know we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And the things we don't know we don't know are actually the most interesting. And one of those that I lie awake at night and I think about how exciting this is. There could be domains of life at temperatures and pressures beyond where cells could survive. Life not based on DNA and proteins as we know it, but life perhaps based on a simpler biochemistry where you have a kind of biofilm that expands in those deep cracks and fissures at very high temperatures and pressures, which moves through the rock using the energy of minerals to survive. And the fact is, we don't know how to look for that life because all the assays right now for life are based on looking for DNA or proteins. And so there could be this entire domain of life with a different biochemistry. And not only would that be tremendously exciting for just knowing how our world works today, but that could be a key for understanding the intermediate steps in the origin of life.
Wow. Well, you certainly made it sound like a very important project. I'm glad we had a chance to talk to you about it, but that's all the time we've got, Robert Hazen.
Joe, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Robert Hazen is the principal investigator for the Deep Carbon Observatory Project. He's senior staff scientist at the Carnegie Institution for Science's Geophysical Laboratory, and he's also a professor of earth sciences at George Mason University.